Yetnebersh Ngusi was 5 when she lost her sight, and it was a big shock for her and her family, and for those in the community who thought that this might have been a curse visited upon her to make her lose her sight. But she went to Addis Ababa and she got educated, and this led to great changes in her life, great independence, and also a life working on the world platform. And Yetnebersh Ngusi joins me now to pick up the story. Yetnebersh, you've graduated from university. Where was it you wanted to take your life at that point? You're a young woman, you're independent, you're obviously strong. What was it you wanted to do?
Well, you know, from our early high school days onwards, I always felt like people have to be accountable for the discrimination and stigma they put on persons with disabilities. And the only way that you can hold them accountable is through the court system. So I always felt that I have to be a judge and make sure that, you know, these people who discriminate people with disabilities, including blind people, need to be penalized. Like, for example, blind people were not allowed to sign in banks. They were not allowed to become judges. So a number of things, a number of restrictions that I have been facing in life. So I decided then I have to become a judge and I have to make sure that the court penalizes these people. That was my early, fresh ambition to do. So I decided to join law school. So I was always wishing that, okay, the first day I graduate, I have to go to the court and make sure that I get cases of discrimination of people with disabilities. So that was the entry point into my global, very comprehensive advocacy that I'm doing now. But I never worked in the court. That really, as I learned more into the law school, I decided to join the human rights advocacy, you know, which also embraces not only the penalizing and the accountability, but also the teaching, the awareness raising, the capacity building piece of advocacy.
So does that mean basically you would like to change the way of thinking? So not just taking one institution, but change the whole viewpoint on disability and discrimination?
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. And I feel that that's a process like which involves not only me as an individual, but also, you know, the whole society, the larger society in focus. As we do it, like now, I'm working for Light for the World, which is a global disability and development organization. So it requires a lot of partnerships and alliances. You know, if you have to change people's mind, it's not as easy as fixing the door of a house.
Have you faced much prejudice over the years to do with your lack of sight?
Absolutely. I mean, the first thing that people tell you is that whenever they see you and you cannot see, they think that seeing is the basic thing that you have to do in life. So they consider if you cannot see, you cannot work. If you cannot work, you cannot get married. You cannot get elected. So all this prejudice is about the restrictions and the limitations that I should have. I have all those, and I have first teachers who tell me that you cannot do this course because you're blind. I have got university professors that are saying that you cannot do this research because you cannot see it and you need to observe and so on and so forth. So my life is full of prejudice and myths.
And it sounds, listening there, it's a list of you cannot do, you cannot, you cannot, you cannot, instead of let's find a way of doing it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think that's the automatic thing that comes into people's mind, and they don't really dig deep and they don't have the moment to think that you have your 99 abilities. Even sometimes they ask me, how can you dress up this nicely without seeing? How can you eat this cleanly without seeing? Also, this very, very silly questions, you know. So I think, yeah, and that blocks people's mentality, and that brings the focus on the disability of the person instead of working on removing the barriers and making it work that you can do things better.
Does it annoy you when people ask you questions like that?
Not at this stage, because at this stage I understand that the problem lies within people. So I understand them, that I'm the solution holder, I'm the pot for the solution. So now, but previously I used to be irritated. How come they ask me this? How come they think this? But now I really, you know, within the social model, you can see the problem lies within the society, and that's how they have been brought up. And there was no lot of information about disability. There was no lot of education about disability. And people with disabilities were not exposed enough. Like, they were hidden in their houses. We didn't see people with disabilities in the cinema. We didn't see them in the theater. We didn't see them in the universities and the schools. So, you know, that has contributed. Those and other factors contributed. So I'm fine now, and because I really see it, it's my responsibility also, not only mine, but also my organization's responsibility to make sure that people understand that we have one disability, but we have thousands of abilities that they should take into consideration. So, well, no more. I'm no more annoyed.
And instead of being married off at the age of 12, you have now married yourself. You married in your late 20s. You've got two daughters. Does that raise questions from people as well? How can you be a mother if you can't see?
Yeah, you know, to be honest, even in terms of stereotypes on disability, it comes very difficult when it comes into women with disabilities, you know. As you know, for example, Helen Keller was not allowed to marry. And three times, she has tried so many times, and her parents didn't allow her, and even she was in relationship with her assistant who used to be an ex-newspaper reporter. So when you're a woman with a disability, and especially marriage in a community like Ethiopia, where marriage is a communal affair rather than an individual affair, somebody needs to get a confirmation and approval of the family's in-law in order to get married. So, yeah, it was not easy. But for me, I think the fact that I excelled all the barriers made me more demanded in the community, and I was lucky to get the right one, who is a sighted man, electrical engineer. And we got married when I was 28, and now we have our two daughters, and I'm expecting my third one on the line. We live a very decent life, but that's not for granted. Quite so many women with disabilities are really discriminated, especially when it comes to marriage, where you cannot do it as a quota. You know, you have to do it upon choice. So the expectation for a woman in Ethiopia is that she has to cook, she has to do all the labor work, the house chores, and women with disabilities are assumed to be unable to do those kind of things. So it was not easy. That's why I'm so happy after the Rights Livelihood Award and after the Spirit of Helen Keller Award I got, we have established a special global award which says her abilities to recognize the achievements of women with disabilities. And this is going to be very exciting because this is going to recognize the abilities of women with disabilities globally. And nominations will open in July. Now we are forming up the jury comprising of amazing women all over the world, from the States, from Africa, from Asia, from Latin America. So we expect that a lot of good things, achievements will be highlighted and spotlighted about women with disabilities. So you're right, marriage, and especially as a woman with a disability, becomes a big challenge in life, even more often so than men with disabilities.
How are your relationships with your family now, all these years on, when you've taken a completely different path than was mapped out for you?
I'm considered as a miracle in the family, being the best breadwinner and becoming the shining. So now I'm counted as the emblem, as the logo for the family, which was not the case and which was never the assumption and the expectation. Yeah, so now I'm the source of pride for the family. And everybody comes to me for anything they rely. And everybody gets proud of being connected with the Etnabersh, you know, the Achiever. So, yeah, that has completely changed.
It sounds, though, we all experience sight loss in a different way and in our own environments and countries, but it sounds like some of the barriers that are put up and some of the challenges seem to be fairly universal no matter where you are in the world.
I fully agree with you, Simon, because the thing is, mostly these things are caused not because of financial capacity or the level of the development of your country. Rather, it's because of the attitudinal barriers, you know. So, for example, blind people in Africa, including the countries where Light for the World work, in Mozambique, in Burkina Faso, in South Sudan, they don't have this technology in place. So they rely a lot on, you know, support of the family to move from place to place. They don't have access to white cans. So mobility becomes a barrier. In the meantime, you know, in big cities like even London and other European cities, still mobility is a challenge because the transport system is not responding. So, I mean, the manifestation may be different, but I think the cause being attitudinal barrier and, you know, the thinking that the thinking that limits services to be only designed for a certain population is common. So yeah, still people, blind people in UK face discrimination. Blind people in Ethiopia, in Burkina Faso face discrimination. The point is, I think the main interlocutor for this challenge is the mind, and the mind is everywhere, unfortunately. But I would hope education would change all this. That's why I'm so keenly working, and Lights for the World, my organization, is keenly working on inclusive education. The more people are educated, then they can be exposed. People with disabilities can be exposed, and I think exposure would be the best teacher, and we would gradually change this scenario. But the thing is, you're right, wherever you are, and whatever is the manifestation type, but still people with disabilities globally, which is around 1 billion, they face sorts of discriminations in the States, in UK, in Europe, as well as in Africa, Asia. The problem is in places where you have a lot of competing economic priorities, like in Africa, where the developing countries are, people with disabilities are the last ones to be considered, and still disability is considered as a charity issue. Whereas in countries like UK, where there is a bit of better understanding of rights, you can demand and you can hold your governments accountable to some extent. But it doesn't mean, I mean, it's all done. You know, the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities, the CRPD, the committee reviewed UK, and the outcomes were really, really shocking, that UK was grossly violating the rights of persons with disabilities. So, yeah, it's still, and it's, that's the same in Africa. So I think we do share the same pain, we do share the same concern, because the problem, where the place where the problem lies is the mind.
So there's so much work to do, but we all have a voice and we all have to use it, don't we?
Absolutely. I think whatever is the amount of problem we do, that's why we really need to do advocacy continuously at every stage, starting from the local and up to the global. That's why, for example, from Light for the World perspective, we do advocacy in New York. In the meantime, we do advocacy in a small village in Zambezi, in Mozambique, in Beira, in Mozambique, because we believe change can happen through a continuous engagement. And for that, we really need to empower persons with disabilities themselves. It's no longer the time that we have other people to speak for us. So we really need to work, because rights do not come as Christmas gifts. We really need to demand them. We really need to struggle and to fight and to change. And that's how, you know, the segregation movements, the black and white movements, Martin Luther King, all of them had to pay price. I'm not saying we need to pay the same price. I would prefer if the world could understand us better and faster, but that's not the reality. So that's why we have to come together, and that's why we need to stand for our rights, because we really need to demand them, to demand them. Otherwise, people will just say, okay, that's fine. They are okay with what they have.
Can we find out more about the work that you do?
Yes, actually, we have a website, lightfortheworld.org, and we are recently also coming into UK. The past 2 years we've been in UK, but I think thanks to technology, you can visit our work on our website, and you can also join our social media paths, importantly. We also work in partnership. We don't work alone, so we work with local partners wherever we go, but we also work with international partners, including organizations like Sightsavers, World Blind Union, the International Disability Alliance. So I think that's very important, that we get connected and we get updated each other. That way we can complement each other in the work we do.
Yet Nabersh Ngusi, you are a tremendous role model for us all, and I really appreciate you taking the time out of your busy schedule to tell us a bit about your life and about your work, and we wish you the best for the future. Thank you for joining us on RNIB Connect Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.